Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. This is Manuel Lemus, the host of the podcast. And as always, I have Michael Kimson, our regular co-host, just returned from the Far East. Is that correct?
Is the rust.
Is that good or bad?
I would think I was saying hello.
Okay.
Or good day. Dobre utra. That's good evening.
Okay, those are weird words. Nobody
would
guess that they would mean something that looks nicer.
Yeah, the transcription woman is going to have a heck of a time with that. Zrast is probably Zdrast, for example.
But
it's just it sounds that my tongue can't even make very well. I've always had a hard time getting my tongue around my R's.
Yeah.
The British listeners will get that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So anyhow, I didn't mean to derail this whole thing.
Yeah.
We're only a minute into this. So how have you been?
Well, I've been...
You've been traveling as well.
Yeah, just returned from Googleplex a couple of weeks ago. There was an event over there. They organized to sort gather people from around the world that helps in the forums of the Google products. I don't know if you ever noticed, if you go to a forum of any of those Google products, near the profile picture and the person name next in each message, there is a level of participation in the forums, and those people that participate for a long time are called top contributors.
TC, yeah.
Right. So since I've been a top contributor for a Google product for many years, they invited me there. I met people from everywhere in the world. And it was quite interesting. It was a bit tiring, but it was a very, very, a very good experience. Despite all the stress of traveling for many hours and waiting for planes, but
yep.
It was well worth it. Well, since they organize it again next year, I'll be there. And cool. What about you? Did you get tired as well?
Well, some. I've been to Australia, and that's about a 32 or 34-hour door-to-door trip. This was door-to-door was probably about 20 hours, so it wasn't quite. I think going there it was 18 or 19, and coming back was about 20, 22, something. So it wasn't as bad as yours. I think yours was about 30 or so, you said?
Yeah, because I have to take a domestic flight in Brazil and then inside U.S.,
yeah,
but it was bearable, but it's tiring.
Yeah, I did a lot of walking, as I mentioned before to you, and used the metro, but did a lot of walking, and I thought I was going to lose a lot of weight because I was doing all this walking, but several miles per day, but it didn't work out when I would have scoops of ice cream in the evening, so I think it balanced out in the end. Yeah.
Well, it was also nice because I met some people in the San Francisco PHP meetup group. I posted a message that was coming there, and like half a dozen people joined me. Despite more wanted to go, in the end, never happens.
I tried to meet JavaScript people in Moscow, and I ended up. Well, I put out a couple of tweets and had a few people. I was emailing with some people, and there was a few people that were going to show up all at one place, but one guy ended up. He ended up having to leave the country. He had some business travel that came up. Somebody else was sick.
Yeah.
Somebody else just never showed up. So it ended up just being me and one chap, Evgeny, and I'm not even going to try to butcher his last name, but he doesn't speak much English, and Dobre utro is about, Я не понимаю по-русски is about the extent of my Russian. So we both sat in this Wi-Fi enabled cafe with iPads and Google Translate up and communicated. And it It was interesting, but we had probably about a 20-minute conversation, which took about 2 hours to have because of the translation stuff. But it was still, he was really fun. We talked about JavaScript, this JavaScript podcast, and he's using Sprout Core, which I said, gosh, that seems really complicated. And he said, well, something like it's got a bit of a learning curve, and my bosses don't really want me to use it, but I'm insisting on using it because it's so powerful. So it's interesting. Sprout Core has spread over to Moscow.
Yeah. Well, it's great. At least you managed to meet somebody. My expectation is that at least half of the people that promised that will be there, they won't make it for some reason. But it was nice anyway.
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, for a lot of these things, it to me it felt like a bigger deal because it's not quite a vacation, but it's, you know, it's a new experience for me. But for people in that city, it's just life comes up and you know, they don't make it. But I had a great time with Evgeny, and I hope next time I go, and I'm kind of tentatively planning on returning to Moscow at least one more time next year. I'd like to get a larger group, hopefully some people that speak a bit more English. I don't think my Russian is going to be much more fluent to talk tech, but
I think it's easier to meet more people if you go to an actual event, because
true,
especially if it is a paid event, because when people pay, they're
going to go. Yeah,
they end up going and not showing up because they already paid. But well, okay, but let's move on because this is actually the Lately in PHP in JavaScript podcast. And well, I've been looking at some interesting news of several things related to JavaScript. One of those things is the Qhopper 8, which is basically an extension, from what I understood, for Node.js that will enable the possibility to start and manage threads. You start, you can create threads and have separate tasks running in parallel, so you do not hold the main thread just to run different tasks in parallel. And this is very interesting because it was something that was being pointed as a limitation in Node.js. I think the core can already fork processes, if I'm not mistaken, but it's not the same thing because processes are a bit more expensive in terms of resources that they consume from the server, the machines on which they are running. And having multi-threading support makes Node.js even more exciting, I think. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I'm reading here about the pieces. Anybody that's listened to me talk knows I'm not a Node expert. I've installed it and played with it and done a little bit of Hello World stuff. Frustrating thing for me was that some of the plugins that I wanted to use, just I couldn't get them working. I submitted a bug report and nobody could help. But through NPM, Node Package Manager. So it looks like this Qoperate is how you install that. NPM install Qoperate. Looks pretty basic. But I'm reading about this and it says the architecture is such that there's a master node server process and then a pool of persistent child node processes. Which those two points sound very much like a standard Apache. You have basically your master Apache server, and then you have the pool of Apache servers that will. Process. It's not really apparent, but yeah. But here, the interesting thing after that is that there's a queue of pending actions or pending requests, and I'm guessing that and I haven't read much of this yet, but it looks like the server, the master server talks to the queue, and there's a queue processor that spins off, files the requests in the first in, first out, over to the particular node processes, child processes. So you know, it's an interesting take. I mean, there's only right now, anyway, with current architecture, there's only so many ways to solve these problems. But the idea of sticking a queue in there is interesting to me, kind of bundling that with the server architecture at the same time.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think that's the way the bind listen calls work. They sort of take a queue of requests and handle them as soon as possible. And but using multi-threading, it distributes them to different threads, so you can handle many simultaneous requests at the same time.
But compared to an Apache situation where you have to say what your maximum number of child processes are, and if they're all being used, at some point somebody's going to make a request to your system, and it's going to say, hey, it's just not going to respond or something.
No, it will queue. Actually, it will queue.
I haven't seen it queue. I typically see stuff.
No, I think it's OS level, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, when you have an excessive number of requests, practically causing a denial of service, the requests may end up being handled later. But if the machine is too heavy for the number of requests, it probably never happen. All those queued requests and will be queued there and never be
processed.
Handled.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this is I think it's a significant improvement. Although, from what I understood, this is not exactly built in the core of Node.js, but hopefully it will be integrated. We'll see. I'm not really following the Node.js developments very closely, but I hope that is what it becomes sooner or later.
Yeah.
Okay, another topic that I wanted to, that I think it would be worth commenting, is there is this library, SockJS, which basically is meant to be a wrapper for implementing WebSocket emulation in different browsers, including those that do not support it. WebSocket is one of those so-called HTML5 APIs that is being added to the more modern browsers. And basically, it allows you to establish network connections to servers out there, so you can implement a more interactive communication with some protocol that allows then other than HTTP. But since not all browsers support it, this SockJS library, it provides an emulation using other communication methods, eventually XML, HTTP requests, and some other approaches. I did not get much into the details, but I thought it was interesting because WebSockets have this potential of enabling applications that require more interactive communication with the servers. Michael, have you looked into this? Do you have any insight?
Well, as with many things, this is interesting to me, and I wonder, I think at this point, if you wanted to do some app that required WebSockets, not knowing how far the SockJS library is, something like this would still be something that you would probably want to investigate. And depending on what your needs are, this may be far enough along that it would work for you. I'm drawing a blank here because I was reminded of another project recently that this reminded me of, not because of the WebSocket aspect, but more just the idea of this is an emulation layer, or it's a wrapper for browsers or JavaScript environments, I should say, that don't support feature X. And I'd like to think that these things wouldn't be necessary, but unfortunately,
well, in the future,
they are. Well, you say, we'd like to think that, but I have a feeling that IE8, for example, I don't know if that supports WebSockets. My guess is that it doesn't. My guess is that IE9 does. But we're going to be probably stuck with some browsers for a long time, for several right. years, that people will need to at least make some gesture towards to say, okay, we you know, this works with native WebSockets, but we'll include this, for example, Sock.js shim library or abstraction library, but it's, to whatever extent, any sort of wrapper like that is probably going to end up introducing some overhead in the emulation. I'm not trying to denigrate the work these guys have done. I think it's fantastic that people are taking these sorts of initiatives into their own hand, because the browser makers aren't doing it. And I guess I may be singling out IE, the kind of the legacy IEs here for a long time. And for a long time, we're going to have to support them. So to the extent that this becomes necessary for some people, I'm glad to see libraries like this. I just wish they weren't necessary.
Right. Well, I agree. I think I would rather not rely on this, just because even the emulation for browsers that do not support it, I'm sure it will be limited somehow for some reason. Because if it was possible to do WebSockets without a more explicit support, probably WebSockets API would not have been necessary. And other than that, what I understood is that those emulations for those browsers that do not support WebSockets, it relies some server-side component that will probably route the requests to an actual socket server, base server, TCP or something like that.
And even here in their documentation, they say that Sock.js does support in the emulation layer. It falls back to a polling mechanism for IE7, for example. But they also say here that it says that technique is quite slow, but there's really nothing that it can do about it. So,
right.
The bigger answer culturally is to get people to stop using older browsers and keep up with current browsers. I just hope we don't get ourselves into a situation where
we need
where
it.
Where there's such a large contingent of people using IE8, for example, and using that for the next 7 or 8 years, that these continue to be necessary.
Right. In my opinion, if I really had an application that could use WebSockets, I'd rather have it disabled, whatever feature it relies on, for browsers that do not support WebSockets. And at least I'll not to have to invest on emulation layers that try to do something that is fantastic, but in the end it's just because the underlying browser is limited. And I don't know, probably these guys had a different motivation to implement those emulation layers, I think. Well,
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Well, moving on, another interesting library that I learned about is it's named Pagify. It's actually a jQuery plugin that it's meant to create single page applications. Well, for those that are not familiar with what are single page applications, you can take, for example, the Twitter web client, which is basically Ajax-based user interface that updates different sections of the page without having to reload it. But you can go back and forth to, virtual pages that have different URLs. And what changes is the hash value that appears in the URL. And this library, from what I understood, also manages dealing with the changes, because when the user changes to another page, probably he followed a link. The link makes changes the hash of the URL, but if the user goes back, the the JavaScript that is in the page, because the page won't be reloaded, but the JavaScript that is in the page has to detect that the hash was changed, and has to actually update the page just to be consistent with the action of going back, probably going to a different screen, a different layout, different things should appear on the page. And this Pagify plugin, I think it does more than just that. If I'm not mistaken, it does something with that which resembles to MVC, or maybe I'm confusing the frameworks, but I think I saw a framework that did that. Anyway, I wanted also to mention, related to this, there is actually an object in JS classes site named JSGet that is already ready to handle these changes in the URL, in the hash of the part of the URL. So not only can change it when to reflect some action that you did, not necessarily clicking on a link, but listen to a virtual event that would be the change of the URL hash. So when the URL hash is changed, you can register a callback function that will be called when that happens, so you can update your screen. So it somehow does at least part of the functionality of that Pagify jQuery plugin. Mike, have you ever tried to develop this kind of single page of applications?
Nope. Nothing to this extent. I've certainly done some apps that have AJAX calls in them and get back some data and update something on the screen, but I typically still am old school. You click a link and will generally bring up a new page. Looking specifically at the Pagify JS thing here and comparing it to what you said about one of the JS classes, and it could. I'm looking here. Just look at their example demo. Oh well, this isn't. Let me look here and see what this says. Because okay, the idea here is that they're setting a holder container and they're passing it some options and then an array of file names or URL names that get associated with particular hash or href containers. And what I noticed initially was that when I went to the demo page, all of the pages were loaded, so that every time I was clicking, it was changing the URL with the hash part of the URL, hash options, hash about, and so on. But looking at Firebug, all the pages were loaded. And you mentioned something about registering a callback, but one of the things that I wonder a bit in apps like this is at least traditional analytics and traditional logging of requests in terms of trying to figure out what pages or what resources people are using on your site would necessarily be lost. That information would be lost with traditional logging mechanisms. Because this just sent a request to the page or to the server for the page about. I might never actually click the about link, but as far as a traditional logging system or traditional analytics app is going to be concerned, this person looked at the about page. So, I'm not advanced enough in this to understand what people are doing to address these sorts of things. We're kind of transitioning. I see this as a transition into the next phase of desktop applications, or I should say browser-based applications, as opposed to web pages. And I think we've been seeing that for a long time. This is not anything
new,
necessarily groundbreaking, but I'm seeing more applications using this technique. How do they deal with analytics? Is it all custom JavaScript logging that logs events back to something else? That's an approach. But
do you mean analytics in the sense of recording requests done by the users to update the statistics that you have for your own site, or...
Sure, yes. Now, whether it's necessarily HTTP requests or just events like, oh, this link was clicked or this div was clicked.
Right. Well, from what I understood, if you mean Google Analytics, for instance, they have an API that you can call to record events and page and stuff.
That's one approach. Personally, I found it a bit cumbersome to use. I think if I wanted to do that, I might try to come up with my own simpler version, but I would probably also want to log stuff to my own system. I don't particularly want all of my hardcore analytic data going to Google, but that's just me.
Well,
says the man with a Gmail address.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, the part of not just analytics, but also search engine optimization, it's a bit of concern. I think it is one of the things that has been holding back people to jump to Ajax applications, was the fact that search engines crawl the pages. They if they just use the hash or URL, they would see the same page, even more because they most of them do not interpret or at least fully interpret the JavaScript in the page to execute it and see if it generates a different content. But there is this convention, they call it Hashbang, which is a convention that I think it was Google that started it. You can notice that in Twitter URLs, you see that there is a base URL that never changes, and there's the hash and then the exclamation mark, and then you see the actual URL with slashes and so. That it's an int for search engines that follow that convention to access when they want to see what content they would see if they fully interpreted the JavaScript in these Ajax-based applications. So if a search engine follows one of those URLs, it maps back to the URL without the hash and the exclamation mark, just using the remainder of the URL. And that is the technique that is used to optimize Ajax applications for search engines, or at least for Google and whatever are the other search engines that follow that convention. And I think that is important, and the libraries like this help because you can, with your own callbacks handlers to that you can register, you can detect the changes when the user uses the back and forward buttons, which do not lead to a new HTTP request, but you have to update your screens. And if you follow the Hashbang convention for mapping your Ajax application URLs, it will be very important for you to have your own site optimized for search engines and still provide the benefits of Ajax-based applications to your end users. And
agree. I would, in my mind, there's a sort of a continuum of types of sites where search engine stuff is important or not important. And I do think a lot of application type things are almost by necessity something where they're behind a login, they're behind some sort of an identification system such that traditional web crawlers wouldn't be hitting them anyway. So we're probably going to start continue to see more advanced use of Hashbang URLs and other things like that to maintain state and take advantage of modern browsers without too much concern for SEO stuff. But at the same time, you could if that's the only trick that somebody knows and they use that trick for their landing pages, for example, they're not going to get much SEO love.
Right. It's just to take advantage of eventually URLs that the user will share, and they are based on the hash URL. If they follow this HashBank convention, at least they can serve search engines the actual page that the user was seeing that moment, and the search engines do not have to interpret any JavaScript. Anyway, this is just to notice that there is now more and more this trend of single page sites or applications. Often they are just dashboards that show different aspects of an application, just as if you have opened a window in a desktop application. And since it provides a better user experience, I think it is a trend that will continue to become more significant, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, moving on with the podcast, Michael, I recall that you wanted to talk about something about PhoneGap.
Sure. PhoneGap. Well, this is an announcement that I saw a couple of days ago that there was an announcement from somebody on the PhoneGap team that they were going to plan to submit PhoneGap, to contribute PhoneGap to the Apache Software Foundation.
Yeah.
Now, that... I'm waiting for a confirmation to see that it actually has happened.
I think it's a process that takes some time to be approved.
Oh no! I mean, yes, it's not going to just happen overnight. But I haven't seen much beyond the initial mention in the mailing list, and then some other articles written about that post. But it really signifies, assuming that the Apache Foundation accepts it, would signify a very strong future for PhoneGap as a technology. It's one of those things where, with almost anything, if people say, gosh, that's kind of neat, but is it going to be around 6 months from now?
Yeah.
Most things that go through the Apache vetting process and become a first-class Apache citizen are going to be with us for a long time.
Well, at least we hope, although it's not guaranteed.
No, you know, certainly nothing. It's not guaranteed, but it's more likely they're going to have resources at their disposal. They're going to it will have proven itself from a technical and I think from an organizational standpoint too. The Apache group themselves are not going to bring into their fold a group of people contributing that don't themselves indicate some level of dedication and structure and organization. So I think if they make it through that vetting process, that it'll be an interesting a twist. Certainly, there hasn't been a lot in the Apache ecosystem that speaks to mobile development or that speaks to JavaScript development all that much. So having PhoneGap be part of the Apache Software Foundation, it feels, assuming it happens, it'll feel like an interesting evolution in both the Apache Foundation and the mobile web ecosystem, to me anyway.
Right. Well, from what I understood from the Apache community process, I'm not sure if that's the exact name. If they approve a project to be included in their umbrella, it basically means that they are confident that the project has strength to move on based on the efforts of its community. So it's never a small project,
right?
Because it would not have enough developers or users to support it. So, but I think PhoneGap will not have any difficulties to be approved.
It does also seem that they're having to consider changing their name from PhoneGap to something else. And that would be one of those... I don't think it would hurt adoption of it long term, but if it's Project X now and then it gets its name changed under the Apache situation, then there may be a period where people are saying, what happened to this? They don't know. They can't remember the name. I'm seeing veiled references to the Gap clothing company, and I don't understand if that's really an issue where the Gap company was saying you can't use PhoneGap. So trademarks and service marks and all that. What a weird world.
And patents. If you look into it, there are patents in the way.
Goodness.
You know, well, you also mentioned something about a build service.
Well, yeah, that's another thing that I just saw yesterday, that the PhoneGap project has a build service located at build.phonegap.com, looks like. And the idea there is that you would upload your JavaScript, CSS, and HTML application, upload all the assets to that, and their build process would give you back iPhone and Android and BlackBerry and other sorts of mobile versions, native app versions of your HTML, CSS, and JavaScript.
Yeah.
And apparently, if you want to do it for the iPhone, you'd have to be part of the iPhone developer program, have to upload your certificates or something like that. So it's So it's not going to be a way for people to make native iPhone apps without having a Mac, without being part of the Apple developer program.
Actually, anyway, that was a clever move, right?
Yeah.
I see.
Similar in some ways to Titanium. I mean, in that you still need that. You still need your SDKs. You still need your certificates and things like that. But this, I wanted to try it today, and I didn't get a chance to. I have a game that I was starting to work on that I wanted to upload to that. But it's not far enough along for me to try it yet. If I get it done in the next couple of months, I would report on whether I actually got that to work or not.
Okay.
But I'll throw this out, because if anybody happens to want to work on this with me, you can email me, michael@kimsel.com. This is a Russia reference. Over in Russia, and I don't know if you saw the pictures or not on my Picasa page, but my brother and I went to the Soviet-era arcade museum, and it's a museum. It's an old warehouse, small warehouse.
I saw some pictures, but I do not recall seeing that. Did you post it recently?
Last week. I posted the pictures last week.
Maybe I skipped it or didn't understand what it was.
Well, there's some movie pictures or some movies of it, too. But these are games, arcade games, some video games. Some are really just like a gun shooting at target sort of stuff. But arcade games, in the truest sense, from the mid-70s, probably the mid to late 80s. And it was really, really interesting to me to play some of these. And there was one game in particular called Gorodki. In English, it would be G-O-R-O-D-K-I. And apparently it's an actual physical game, sort of a sports game, kind of like bowling or Skittles or something. But it was a very, very simple video game. And I was looking at it and saying, somebody should make this as an iPhone game. Somebody should make this as... I found a web version where you can play it, and it looks like they just took the ROMs from the machine and got them into a web system somehow. But it strikes me as a simple enough yet addictive enough game that I was starting to play around with some JavaScript and see if I could make that happen and then perhaps convert it via PhoneGap into an iPhone game. But alas, I'm not that good. I'm not that far enough along yet. But if anybody would actually like to work on that game with me, I would be... I'm interested in talking with you. I may not have time for a while, but shoot me an email.
Yeah. Right.
If somebody actually has the game already as an iPhone game, maybe just under a different name, let me know, because I will buy it.
Well, we talked a lot about PhoneGap, but I think it's a very well-known project. But for those that are listening and are not familiar with it, it's basically, should I call it a framework that... allows you to write mobile phone applications just using some HTML, JavaScript, and CSS. So that's why it is related with this podcast, because it talks a lot about the related topics. But for those not familiar, it could be weird. But it looks interesting also along the Titanium accelerator that was also mentioned. It's good to see these projects moving, and providing more opportunities to JavaScript developers.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but moving on with our podcast, now you are reaching closer to the end. Now I would introduce the regular section on the latest JavaScript objects published in the JS Classes site. But first, I'd like to mention a new feature that was recently introduced, not only in JS Classes site, but also in PHP Classes site, because they share the same code base, which is basically to a feature that allows to highlight which are the top developers that are contributing to the sites. That feature existed practically since the beginning of the site. Basically, every day the site computes a ranking of the authors of the site based on the number of users, distinct users that have downloaded their packages from the site. And since this only applies, of course, to packages that require the user to be logged to download, because that's the way the site keeps track of who has downloaded what. And the site every day builds some rankings of the site top authors. There is one global ranking for all time, and there is also another ranking just for the last week. So the authors that have just submitted their packages recently, you can see already them rising to the top of this chart. But what's new this time is that there is now a couple of additional rankings, which are also for all time and for the last week, but they are restricted to each country of the actual author that have submitted the packages. So if you are from a certain country, let's say Michael submitted a package and he's from the United States, there will be a ranking for authors of the United States that show how high is Michael ranking.
I'm number one.
Yeah.
Well,
so, sort of like
perhaps,
that.
Yes.
If you had many users downloading recently your packages, you will feature in the week rank, and it will be easier to rank in your just considering the users of your own country, because there are less users, there are authors to consider. And this is yet another feature that was meant to encourage authors to submit their packages, because they get more evidence. Their work shows more every time they submit a package, and it becomes highly ranked. And with these national ranks, it is easier to see yourself rise in the ranks. And I hope this encourages authors to submit more packages, so they can see themselves rising, and somehow provide some satisfaction for the work they have shared with many other users. But yes. Moving on with the section on which we talk about the latest objects published in the JS Classes site. Michael, which objects would you like to highlight this month?
Well, speaking of users who have contributed packages and shared, we're back with Arturs Sosins. Good morning,
yeah.
Arturs, who's actually contributed a number of things this month. One of his I'd like to talk about, which stands out to me, is the Canvas Turtle, and this it stands out to me a little bit because it takes me back to Logo, the idea of the turtle as a little object on the screen, and you give it commands. Now, it wasn't the very first programming that I ever did, but I did some Logo programming as a very young child, and it was kind of, I was already doing other stuff in BASIC, which was allowed me to be more expressive, but Logo did help get some ideas about how to move stuff out, move stuff around, rotating and turning and kind of thinking sort of like a video game. I'm here, I'm going to turn left, I'm going to turn right. And it looks like what Arturus has done is recreated the idea of the turtle commands and placed them on a JavaScript canvas. So you can issue those same commands and get the same, or get similar results. So it's an interesting, for me, it's very nostalgic and a bit of a throwback, because I haven't actually played with Logo in probably 30 years.
Yeah. Well, I think that is quite nice. When you, just to make clear, when you say commands, it's basically, well, some commands are more of control of logic, and other commands are mostly of drawing graphics. That's why it is related with the canvas. And,
there's actually a lot of good documentation that Arturus has provided here. So you'd say, draw 50, and you'll draw 50 pixels. You'll go forward 50 pixels, then you turn right 90 degrees, and then you do another 50 pixels, and you keep doing that, and you'll draw a box, for example.
And what is interesting is that basically this... this language of commands is becomes interpreted, and so you can write a small program, which is a bunch of commands written as text, and you can execute the program and see how what it produces on screen. And I think it is in the early days of introducing this Logo-like languages is to let people learn about programming. And in this case, it is interesting because Arturus implemented an interpreter, and it could be interesting for those that would like to study this code to learn how to develop interpreters of commands for any purpose, not just necessarily for drawing graphics.
Sure.
Other than that, you also wanted to comment another?
Well, yeah, Daniel Carrero, let me say it right, Daniel Carrero from Chile has put together, when I first saw, I actually misread it the first time I saw it, and I thought it was this jQuery Marquee title, and I thought it was just another jQuery Marquee, just another Marquee effect, and in some ways it is, but as soon as I clicked the live example, I went, oh, okay.
It's not that what you thought.
It's not what I thought. It's just, it's doing a marquee effect, a text scrolling effect, just on the title in the browser.
The
page title. But what's interesting, so this is an animation of the title, but as a side effect, because I don't think I've ever seen this done, or if I have, it's been a long time. It's been in the tabs as well, too. So... it was actually very interesting just to see that happening. Now, unfortunately, I was thinking this might be a good thing to use for notification. It doesn't look like... it does. In Chrome, the title in the tab will continue to animate. Now, in Firefox, it doesn't, but it does in Chrome. So... I guess that would be an interesting way of giving some notification to somebody, even if they're not on our page, but if they see the tab there that, hey, it's changing, something's going on.
Yeah, it's it will give a distinct feature to your site pages, because this is not a normal thing, and a site that uses that will probably get the attention of the user, making a title rotate on the page.
Sure. Now, how about you?
Well, actually, I have also considered a couple interesting classes. One also from Arturus. He's practically dominating the site. He's number one not only in Latvia but also in the worldwide ranking. And one of the classes that I wanted to comment about is this glint effect, which is basically an effect of showing a sort of lightning on top of a page element, but it sort of shifts either horizontally or vertically. It's an option. And it is, although it's not exactly new, this type of things, it always gives a distinct aspect to the pages that use these effects. And it's all done in JavaScript. There is no Flash necessary to implement these things. And in this case, he also uses a canvas to render the lightning image that shifts on top of the page element, and then he uses he shifts the position to give the sensation of having something a light animated on top of these page elements.
Sure.
And it certainly looks cool, and that was one of the objects that I wanted to mention. And another object that I also wanted to mention, not by coincidence, is another object by Arthur Sossin's, that basically it implements, it's called Pop Hunter, but in practice it displays a sort of interstitial advertising. Usually this is called advertising, but could be for other purposes. Basically, an intermediate screen that shows on a page when you visit that page, and it goes away after a few seconds. So it's just to bring attention to something that happens on the site. Could be advertising or not. And this kind of components are useful for people that want to enhance their sites, bringing the attention of the user for something that is relevant. Well, basically about JavaScript objects, it's we have covered few of the most interesting that are published recently. And this month I sort of switched the order. Usually talk about the latest articles that are being published in the JS Mag magazine. Michael, I don't know if you have anything ready to comment this month.
Well, yeah, a couple of things. We're actually, I'm looking here right now at our upcoming list. We actually had a lot that were on hold this month due to some people had some life situations. But we've got a piece on CSS color formats and how to modify those with JavaScript. Dino Gambone is continuing his JavaScript game development series, and actually it looks like there's one more that that's right. This is a new author for us. Daniel Gita, hope I'm saying the name right, has a piece on doing blur effects in JavaScript. So those are, I think there's maybe one more, but those are the major ones. We've had a couple that were going to be this month, but due to scheduling, we're having to push them back to next month.
Yeah.
And actually, one very, very brief comment, because we're always looking for new authors to publish or continuing authors. You can email me, michael@jsmag.com, and we can take it from there if you have any questions. Typically, and this has only been an issue once, but I'll bring it up because somebody said, hey, I've got this piece, I want to do it, and English is not their first language. Now, we've had other people in the past where English is not their first language, and through our editors, we've been able to tweak a few things here and there. We had an issue this time where just the translation and our ability to translate was not up to speed, and so we're having to take a lot more time on that one, but other than that, like out of the last 2 years we've been doing this, we've had that happen one time. So it certainly is an issue. And having been in Russia for the last 10 days, I certainly understand not being able to speak like a native. I felt like a 2-year-old sometimes because in my head, I'm an intelligent person with cogent thoughts. I couldn't communicate those to anybody in writing or in speech or anything. I felt very helpless at times. So I've been in your shoes. I understand what it's like to not know all the phrases and how best to say things. We'll still work with you as best we can. So michael@jsmag.com if you want to contribute something, if you want to talk about an article, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, and you pay for your contributions, as always.
Yes.
Well, okay, it has been yet another great show of the Lately in JavaScript podcast. On my part, that's all for now, and I hope to see you back next month. Bye.
Yeah, I will see you next month as well. Thank you very much, Manuel.